When is quitting the workforce a good economic sign? I'm Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In this week's edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley will explain the silver lining in a seemingly disappointing news story. Plus, he'll share tips on getting human help with doing taxes and makes the case for keeping the headlights on while driving. Plus, answers to your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So usually the news of lost jobs is a negative for the economy, but a couple of recent reports could actually be a positive. Kevin, how does that work?
Well, it started a big news storm last week. There was a Congressional Budget Office report that said that the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, would cause several million jobs to be lost over the future. And in a shocking, huge surprise, critics of the president and his health care legislation jumped on this and said, see, I told you, this was terrible. This is horrible. It's the worst thing to ever happen. But in this case, anyway, they may have missed the point.
Well, what is the point?
And the report said it's actually not less work available. It's less workers. And even then, it's less equivalent workers. These are people who will be leaving the workforce by choice or scaling back their hours, mostly because they won't be forced to work just for health insurance. These are probably people in their, oh, I'd say mid-50s or early 60s who might have a pension, or they're financially secure enough where they don't need to work for the money, but they weren't old enough to qualify for Medicare. And so they could leave the workforce and get subsidized health insurance on their own before qualifying for Medicare at 65. Certainly some issues with the government subsidizing these people, being able to work for the form of tax credits, and also people, you know, manipulating their income, if you will, so that they don't exceed the income limit so they can still get the subsidies. But basically, the story really was people who want to work less will be able to work less or not at all, which will leave jobs for those who actually need the money or need to get employer-provided health insurance if that's the reason that those people want to work.
And then there was another report regarding quitters.
Correct. This was from the Labor Department. They said 2.4 million people resigned from their jobs voluntarily last November. That was about 1.8% of the workforce, the highest since the recovery started about 5.5 years ago. Not quite what it was when things were going really well, but still a very high number and a very encouraging number.
Well, why is that encouraging? Why is that a good sign for the economy?
Well, it's because it shows that people are confident in, first of all, their ability to retire. Maybe that they've decided just to take this job and shove it. They've had enough of it. They've had an increase in their assets to the point where they say, I'm old enough now, I can leave. Or they're leaving because they think they can find, or they have found, a new job, a better job, one that's more suitable. It might be higher wages. It might be less stressful for them, or lower or more flexible hours. And again, when those people leave those jobs because they're confident in the economy and their situation, it means that a new job opens up for workers to move up the ladder.
Scared me for a second there, Kevin, when you said take this job and shove it, you know.
Don't take that quote out of context. Please do not shove this job.
But are there any drawbacks to the increase in quitters?
Generally, when it's voluntary for the workers, mobility and turnover is good. It's good for the economy, and it's definitely good for the individuals if they're making decisions, acting in their own best interest. One area where this might be a cause for concern, and it shouldn't be a reason for individuals not to do this, but when you have people who were working and contributing to Social Security, and they decide, I'm going to retire because I can, and they start tapping into Social Security, that could lead to a drawdown somewhat in the assets, although the replacing workers will then, of course, start paying into Social Security as well, which will help keep the system stronger. I worry a little bit about this when people come to me in my grown-up private practice and say, hey, I have had so much money accumulate in the stock market over the last 5 years. If I make 10% a year for the next 30 years, I can retire comfortably right now. And while I certainly hope that happens in the form of higher returns in the stock market, I don't think it will, and I don't like people to predicate their own financial security on leaving a job that they would otherwise stay at for that. So if they're hoping for more of the same, you might want to think twice about that.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin about any money matter, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and Joyce says, is it wise to cash in a beneficiary IRA or rollover into another account? She's concerned about tax implications. So is it better to pay up front or later with year-end taxes, Kevin?
I'm sorry, was there false praise?
There was none. None at all.
And we're taking it anyway. Wow. The standards.
And her name is Joyce, too.
Well, she sounds like a nice person. Then yes. I guess we'll take this call. Let's go over what a beneficiary IRA is first. And when an IRA owner dies, in theory, they have beneficiary named on their account, where that's where the IRA assets are supposed to go to. It can go to one person. It can be split up among several people. But that is the designation that immediately determines where that money should go. It actually supersedes usually language in a will or a trust. So the beneficiaries get the account and they get the access to the money. Technically, Joyce can cash out immediately, but whatever she pulls out of that IRA will technically be taxable income. She cannot roll it over into a different account. She has to keep it as an inherited IRA. So she can either cash it in there or leave it in there, but there is a third option, which she not only should do, but it's probably the best course of action for someone in her situation.
What is the third option?
First, take what you have to. When you are an inheritor of a beneficiary IRA, you were required to at least take out the required minimum distribution every single year. That is generally based on your age and what the IRS has determined to be your life expectancy. And again, you have to do it by the end of each year. And if you don't take that dollar amount out, there can be a 50% excise tax imposed on that dollar amount. So if you were supposed to take $10,000 out and you didn't, they could hit you with a $5,000 penalty for not doing so, and you still have to take it out and pay taxes on it. But even people in that situation who don't necessarily need the money may still want to take a little bit more out of that RMD than they otherwise, or from the IRA rather, than they otherwise would have to.
And then pay more in taxes.
They would have to pay more in taxes on it, but there are a couple of ways to mitigate that tax. If they are working, they can pull the money out of the beneficiary IRA, and then increase their contributions, hopefully, to a pre-tax retirement plan like an IRA or a 401k or a 403b, and offset the taxes that would otherwise be incurred because of that distribution from the beneficiary IRA. The big thing to think about in this, in a situation like Joyce's and everybody else, is you want to stay below the highest tax brackets whenever you possibly can. And again, that's from 15% at the federal level, jumping up to 25%. And usually that's about $90,000 of gross income for married couples filing jointly, and about half of that for single filers. So if you're going to take money from a beneficiary IRA or any other kind of taxable distribution, you want to try to get up to just to that level, but then take no more out if you possibly can.
And speaking of retirement accounts, next week's edition of On Your Money is going to be, drum roll please, a special membership drive edition. Yes, it is pledge drive time. And you, Kevin, have prepared one of your most popular mini money booklets to celebrate the event.
Yes. As a thank you to those who pledge at any level, we provide a On Your Money mini money booklet. And this one answers our most asked questions. It's called Retire Early, and forever. Ooh. Retire early and forever. It's suitable for people who are thinking about retiring or for people who want to stay retired. How and where they should save. Figure out your progress. Figure out after retirement when to take Social Security. How to figure out how much you can spend. And I checked back on this, Joy, and we have not offered this On Your Money, Mini Money booklet covering this particular subject for 5 years. Ooh. 2009 was the last time we offered this this particular version, and it may be another 5 years until we offer it again. And so if you are thinking about retirement in that period of time, you may want to tune in next week and pledge at least $1 to the good people at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Retire Early and Forever. I like that title. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for him, he's here to answer your personal finance questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And we do have some callers with questions or comments. Matt in Oshkosh, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to know why people don't seem to see this discrepancy in this report from whatever the board is that reported on the jobs, the people that are supposedly leaving these jobs. I look at this and I say the report said there was going to be about 2.5 million fewer jobs. If these people are leaving voluntarily, because they now suddenly have this freedom that they don't have to keep these jobs for health insurance. We have millions unemployed. If these jobs were not going away, they would be replacing these people with other unemployed people, and we wouldn't be seeing fewer jobs. I just can't get my head around this, that we're supposed to just believe that these people are leaving the workforce. We're having 2.5 million jobs, and this is a good thing. 2.5 million job loss, and this is a good thing. Could you explain that further?
What's again, it's not that it's the jobs aren't being lost. The people are going to be working less. In theory, there will be need to be new people working to replace these people who are leaving. And I see this a lot. Most of the people with whom I work are in their 50s and 60s, and generally due to some good luck and some discipline saving, they have enough money to retire. But many of them would come to me and said, we never thought we would have 1/10 of the money that we have. But we have this money. What we don't have is access to health insurance outside of our workforce. So therefore, we have to stay and keep working at a job that we would just as soon not work at. And we would just for health insurance. And so we would really like to leave this job and retire or go work someplace else that maybe doesn't provide health insurance or is a part-time job or something like that. And they can't because they could not get health insurance up until this year. Now, because they are able to purchase subsidized health insurance or on their own, or they don't have the hurdle of a pre-existing condition preventing them from getting health insurance, they can leave the workforce voluntarily or cut back on their hours, and somebody else can step up to take their place.
Yeah, and presumably, somebody will be filling that job that the 50 or 60-year-old left.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We are talking with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And we are welcoming your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You are listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our first caller is Jeremy in Fond du Lac. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a big fan of the show. I have my On Your Money mug in hand.
I don't even have one of those anymore.
Really.
I would like it.
That's a classic.
It's been holding up well. In the beginning of 2013, I fully funded my Roth IRA, and I put investments in three different funds. And at the end of the year, I found out through my W-2 that my income is in that area where I can't make the full contribution amount, and I need to take out $1,000. Now, I kind of have an ethical and legal question because In choosing which fund I take it out of, I naturally would want to take it out of my least performing fund. But it seems kind of unethical because I already know which one is least performing. And when I'm looking through all of these tax rules, I'm kind of looking at them and thinking, well, why didn't I just put in $20,000 and then take it all out after I knew which funds were going to do well?
What happened is the earnings portion of that, you can always pull the contribution to a Roth IRA back out with no taxes or penalties. And of course, as you probably hopefully know already, Jeremy, you do have to back this out if it were what they would consider to be an illegal contribution. The problem is if you leave the earnings in there, you pay penalties on the earnings from that as long as they're left in there. And there is some option to choose it, and it really only comes to the fact is if you get audited and if they catch it and if they say they're upset about it, that's when the problems start kicking in. Where I have a bigger issue is you're making a mistake in the way that you're referring to investments, and you're considering them to be objects in perpetual motion, and you're saying that they are performing well. And I would prefer that you use the phrase "have performed well," and that's useful because first of all, it's true they have performed well, but that's no guarantee that they will continue to do so. And second of all, you have to remember what John Bogle, the legendary Vanguard mouthpiece, said a long time ago, that investment performance has a regression to the mean component, which means what goes up is likely to come down and what's gone down is likely to come up. So I think that that you sound like you're on track for the technicalities of backing out that illicit Roth IRA contribution, but I would have you take it out. I'd actually, if you said, which one should I take? If you said you have to take one, I would have you remove the one that has done the best for you, because the longer you leave that in there, the less likely it is to perform at the same level it has been in the past.
Okay, thanks for your advice.
I like that, Kevin. I never thought of it that way. Phil in Crystal Lake is with us. Hi, Phil.
Hello. Actually, this is Phil's wife. We have $50,000 in a savings account that is earning, you know, practically no money whatsoever. In fact, we're being penalized with it now. And I'm wondering what would be the best investment that we can do on our own. We do have someone helping us, but I would like to just move it myself.
Right. And it's a very common complaint, Bill's wife, that
I want to say we're both retired, too.
Okay. So. Well, I'll take your word for that as well, in the fact that you really do have a husband named Phil. I have no reason to doubt that that's true or that you really are retired.
Wait a minute. Phil's wife, what is your first name?
Margaret.
Margaret, okay.
Great. Hello, Margaret. I like that you have that when you want to call into a radio show, you have the kind of relationship where you go, dial up that On Your Money and get him on the line. I'll be getting another piece of toast. And then, is he on? All right, give him to me.
How did you know? He said to be sure to tell you you're a great investment guru.
I like your husband even more as every minute passes. Phil's wife, what I would say to do is a couple things. First of all, I think you're barking up the right tree by trying to do this on your own. The problem with taking money to a financial advisor, depending on the financial advisor, is that if they are going to offer you things like stock funds or bond funds that they traditionally will present to you, there's nothing wrong with them. But there's a very good chance that those could and will go down in value at some point. And then that little extra inch of return, 1%, 2% more you might have earned in the long run per year, can be wiped out in a bad year. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you just have to know that going into it. And it doesn't sound like this is the kind of money that you are willing to take that chance with, correct?
Correct. We want to protect the principal at least.
Okay. There are two different ways I would go with it. One is check around at your local financial institutions and look for certificates of deposit. Find ones that, you know, are 3 to 5 or 7 years if you can. And accept the fact that you're probably only going to get maybe 1 to 2% on that. But that's better than nothing.
Yeah, we're getting, locally, it's about 0.5.
Okay, well, and that's fairly competitive. A lot of people come to me and say, well, you know, I'm getting screwed over by my credit union or my bank. They're only paying me 0.5%. And that's actually on short-term savings, that's a competitive rate. That's the first thing I would suggest you do. And if you don't find anything that's suitable, go online at a place like bankrate.com. They shop around and try to find the highest CDs in the country. And sometimes you can find things that are closer to 2%. Again, if you're willing to go out a longer term and you're willing to be subject to the substantial penalty for early withdrawal, which typically is 6 months to a year's worth of interest. But if you took out, let's say, a CD that paid 2% over 5 years, 2% per year over 5 years, and then you took it out after a year, you'll still be back to square one, which is just about where you're at. And the longer you leave it in past that, the more money that you will earn. Second thing I would look at, and we'll be talking about these in a few weeks, but those Series I savings bonds, they're a pain to set up. You have to go to the Treasury website and do it yourself. You have to transmit the money electronically. But those pay 1.18%. It's an adjustable interest rate that changes every May 1st and November 1st. You can pull them out after 12 months with only a three-month penalty of interest. The bad news is you can only put $10,000 in per person per year. Once you get the account set up, it's much easier to contribute more money to it in the future. The great thing about these is that you don't have to pay taxes on the interest until you actually cash the bond in if you don't want to. And so it can be a nice tax-deferred vehicle for people who are trying to avoid taxes and don't necessarily need the money. So long-term CDs and Series I savings bonds.
Okay, the online one, I did find one that was 2%. And I guess I'm afraid to go online and do that. I don't bank online either. So.
Yeah, and there's reason to be fearful for that. I still think that sending anything via the regular mail, as efficient and safe as the U.S. Postal Service is, it's probably riskier to send a check through the mail than it is to wire money online. But I understand your concern for it. I will say this. There are billions and billions and billions of dollars that are transmitted electronically every single day in America alone. And we rarely hear about any issues of that money being grabbed from someone who shouldn't be grabbing it along the way. But I understand what you're saying, and that's going to be part of the decision you have to make. Is it worth any apprehension you have about banking online, which, by the way, we're all going to be banking online all the time anyway fairly soon. But right now, you still can go to your local place and get a lower rate, or you can get a little bit more interest and go online.
Thank you very much, Margaret, for the call. Good luck to you and Phil. We have John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. I have a question. I'll probably have you guys rolling your eyes.
But we do it every question, John. So
that my mom took out for me when I was a kid. I'm just wondering, how do you collect on term life insurance without dying?
Actually, that's a very good question. It is possible to collect money on term life insurance policies without dying. Not every one of them, and not very much money, but some life insurance policies, term included, have a feature for long-term care or what they call sometimes like an advanced death benefit that says if we take a reduced amount of money now, we will forego the death benefit in the future for it. But of course, because it's a pay-as-you-go policy, there's an advantage to you to do something like that and then stop paying for it, whereas the insurance company predicated these rates on you paying this same amount of term over the whole time. Do you actually need the money from it, or do you just say, I don't need the policy, I don't know what to do with it, and I don't want to keep it going?
It's only, well, I don't know what it's worth now. It's a $5,000 policy. No, I don't really need the money, but I thought it'd be nice to have some extra cash to invest or something, you know. Yeah, I guess it accrues. I don't know. Do they surpass the $5,000 limit, or is it
if it's separate? If it's an actual term policy, a typical one, no, they don't. You get what you pay for. If you make the premium payment, you have $5,000 of coverage until the next payment is due, and you have nothing more than that. There are some term policies that they have where you can pay in a higher premium over the life of the policy, and then if you don't die, you get extra money back at the end of the term if you don't want it. There are other ones that have some kind of payout factor in special circumstances, but in most of these, especially these smaller ones, there's probably no opportunity to get any extra cash back other than by dying. Quite frankly, I don't think it's worth it.
Oh, okay. Great.
Please don't do that. No, I guess I don't get it. I'm not rolling my eyes, John. You said your mother took this policy out?
Yeah, I guess I was about 10 years old, I've just been paying. Well, I stopped paying on it. The dividends have started paying the premiums.
I don't think you have a term policy then.
Oh, no? Oh,
No, I think you have a cash value policy, and that's an entirely different question that you'll have to ask at another time. No, I'm just kidding. Then you actually do have some cash value to it. You have something that's generating investment income that's covering the policy. And from the story, John, I would say that that actually is the case because usually when these policies were sold to parents of younger children, they wouldn't sell them term policies. They would sell them cash value policies that did actually have some investment component. It wasn't nearly as good of a deal as the salesperson told your mother it was, but I think it still has some cash value to it, and then you can actually take it out and spend the cash as you please. There might be some tax liability to it, not a huge one likely, but yeah, if you need the cash, I bet there is cash in there if it's kicking off dividends.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Good luck, John.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, because I was trying to figure out, I wouldn't think a parent would need to or want to take out a term life insurance policy on a young child.
Gosh, my parents took out millions of dollars of life insurance on me. I think they still are taking it out as we speak.
I'd be a little suspicious, Kevin. No. I should give numbers. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And now it is time for the Smart Assets segment of the show. And recently we discussed the do-it-yourself methods of doing your own taxes. Today we'll tell you the ways to get some help from actual human beings. So how do we find a tax preparer, Kevin?
Well, before you go to a tax preparer, and if you just have questions, you may want to start with the IRS. Go to the website, irs.gov, and actually they have a frequently asked questions section called the Intuitive Tax Assistant that kind of takes you through a process of saying, it says yes, no, how much is this, how much is this, are you this, then this is the answer. And that's probably the fastest way to get questions answered, and we'll put links to those particular web pages up at onyourmoney.com later on. You can also call the IRS with questions, 800-829-1040. There's an app you can download called IRS2Go. Back in the old days, of course, you'd walk down to the IRS office, wait in line with your question, and they would eventually get to you. But the IRS is moving away from getting that face-to-face help. They prefer that you use the web, and even when it comes to calling them. Last year, there was a study, and this is from the IRS. They said they only answered about two-thirds of the phone calls, and the average wait time was 18 minutes, and that compares to an average wait time of 2.6 minutes in 2004. Hmm. And even if you are fortunate enough to get a representative from the IRS on the phone, several studies over the years have shown that there's a good chance you're going to get either a wrong answer, or if you call twice with the same question, you might get two different answers.
But the IRS isn't going to prepare my return for me, though.
No, they are not. So if you are actually looking for a person to do that for you for little or no cost, you can check out the VITA program, V-I-T-A. That's Volunteer Income Tax Assistance. And then there is also another group called TCE, which helps older people do their taxes. And there are some income limitations and parameters to doing this, but a lot of people will fit. It's usually $58,000 of income or less. And the link is long. It's at the IRS website, and it's called Free Tax Prep. But again, we'll put a shorter link up to that, up to onyourmoney.com. And then there is another site you can go to that Walmart and Goodwill and the United Way have put together to help people who have, for some reason, are either lower income, elderly, or disabled, get their taxes done. It's called myfreetaxes.com.
All right. What if you are able or willing to pay a little bit more for more personal attention?
Then you want your own tax preparer or CPA, and you can, of course, can go to the chains like H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt. And, you know, I've heard some stories which I would cause me to shy away from those, but other people have used those services for years and been fairly happy with it. And if you want to find your own, one of the best ways to do it is just ask a friend and say, hey, do you do your own taxes, or do you have someone you could recommend? Or talk to a lawyer or financial advisor or insurance agent or banker and say, who is a CPA or tax preparer you might recommend I could talk to? And because there is a law in place now where taxpayer assistors have to have a tax ID number for themselves, there's a new directory you can go. It makes it much easier to find a tax preparer or CPA in your area. It's at ptindirectory.com, ptindirectory.com.
So do you recommend we might ask some questions of a potential tax preparer?
Sure, and this is one of the toughest ones for a lot of the people in our listening area to ask, but is definitely one of the first ones should be, what is this going to cost me?
How much?
And you can, how much? Mm-hmm. And you can expect to spend anywhere from $100 for a preparer up to $1,000 or more for a CPA, and especially if you have rental properties or a business or a more complicated estate situation. And then ask for that price. Okay, what do I get? Do I, I'm going to talk to you in the next week? Are we going to sit down together regularly, or do you do any analysis, or do you just prepare the return, tell me how much I owe? And if you are going to go to a CPA, and if you have a more complex situation, I do recommend you use an actual CPA and spend the money. But ask the CPA if he or she specializes in your particular situation. You know, again, if you do have a rental property or a small business, ask the CPA, are you good at that, or is there someone else at your firm who specializes in that, who can help me out? And are you going to provide year-round assistance with quarterly filings and those other things, or am I still on my own for that? Some of the red flags to look out for is, don't let the tax preparer base his or her fees on your refund. Watch out if they promise you more money than you could probably get from another preparer in terms of a refund, or if they're really aggressive with deductions. And finally, you know, check on the background through the Better Business Bureau and see if there are other complaints as well.
Mm-hmm. Why do you suppose it's so hard for us to ask how much?
Because that's just our
nature.
Our genetic nature background for many of us is, we're just not, we don't like that confrontation. And when people come to me, a lot of times I say, well, who's your CPA? I'll probably be working with him or her on a regular basis. And I say, you know, do you like him or her? And they go, you know, he or she charges a lot or whatever. I say, well, have you asked to say, is there a way I can still use your services and pay less? And that's a fair question. They'll either say, yes, here's how, or no, you can't. And then you know mm-hmm. what your next decision is.
1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question for Kevin. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Gail in Watertown is with us next. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My daughter is 18, out of high school, and she has a job that she really likes. She gets called in for projects, and she's saving money for college. Now, this year, at the end of the year, they told her she's an independent contractor, and the way I see things, she's not. But what do we do on our taxes? I really don't think she's going to go to the employer and say, hey, you do this wrong, because she really wants that job.
That is a very tricky situation, because what the IRS says to do is to contact the employer and say, you know, I need to get one of these. Why not? And then they say, contact the IRS and say, give me the name, address, and city and zip code and of the employer. And when you're employed and the wages, et cetera. And one of the reasons the employer might not like that is the employer doesn't like the notion of delineating between employee and independent contractor for tax reasons. Mm-hmm. And as much as it might hurt her to lose that job, it's going to hurt her even more if she gets in trouble for not filing her taxes properly. So that's the best way to go. You still have to file your tax return and an extension if you don't get it. But I would check with the IRS and say, you know, what should we do in this situation that we didn't get the W-2? If you want to just say that you're an independent contractor, you sure can do that. You are probably not going to be the one who suffers the consequences if that's found out to be otherwise, but I sure wouldn't want to take that chance.
Oh, no. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Gail, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm going to be a star. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and Kevin, a simple trick that will cost drivers a few pennies up front could save us a lot more money down the road, as well as save lives. What should we be doing, Kevin?
This one weird trick that people from Pewaukee are using, it just sounded like those internet ads that I see a lot. Turn on your headlights. Yesterday, I was unfortunate enough to be driving around in the snow, and it was amazing how little visibility was available, yet how few people actually had turned their headlights on. And winter, sorry to say, is not over yet. And even when it does finally end, if it finally ends, it's going to be raining. And then, of course, daylight savings time is going to be changing, so it's more likely you're going to be driving home in the dark within a few weeks. And so you can increase your safety quite a bit just by clicking those lights on the minute you get in the car and then turning them off once you get home.
Wow. So let's start with the cost of this. Will that cost more money to keep my headlights on?
Yeah, that's the only reason I can think of that people don't turn their headlights on, is because they think that they're saving money. And, you know, they've been told since they were little kids to turn the light off if they're not in the room. Well, they figure if it's sunny out, or daylight at least, that they that they have to turn their headlights off as well. Depends on the type of the headlight and the vehicle, and the cost of the electricity is zero. But if we look at, let's say, you know, a bulb, and the bulb is, again, let's say $20 or so. The life expectancy of a bulb is hard to nail down as well. But if we assume 500 hours and assume that you drive 30 miles an hour on average for those 500 hours, that works out to about 0.1 cents per mile. So 0.1 cents per mile. So in other words, leaving your headlights on cost about a penny for every 10 miles per bulb.
All right. It's funny because my husband, who follows me around turning off lights in the bedroom, does have his headlights on constantly.
Good.
Because he thinks it's safer, and it is safer.
He is correct.
What are the rules regarding headlight use? He doesn't have to have them on during the day.
And I know how much it pained you, Joy, to admit that your husband actually
was
correct.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
The laws are determined by each state. In Wisconsin, you have to turn them on at least 30 minutes after sunset and 30 minutes before sunrise, or when you can't see at least 500 feet ahead. And that's typically, depending on the speed, that's about the window of vision for when you have the headlights on. But again, those are the laws. But it is safer just to turn them on and leave them on.
You know, what are the advantages of headlights, using them continuously?
I turn mine on right when I get in the car, and then I never forget to turn them on. You're more likely to be – it's not about seeing. You know, that's where the laws are basically predicated, but it's about being seen. Mm-hmm. And you're more likely to be seen by people who are going to be pulling out at an intersection. They're more likely to see you coming and stop first. And in this kind of weather and at this time of year, having your headlights on means that your taillights are on. And when your taillights are on, that means the person who is following you too close behind you, jabbering on his or her cell phone, there's one more little key that might cue them in that your vehicle is ahead of theirs, and they might need to give you some space or slow down before they run into you.
Well, you'll be happy to know, Kevin, that you and Rob are convincing me to do this more often, in that I am. But you know what I used to do is I've had times where I've forgotten to turn off the headlights back in the old days when you didn't have, you know, bells and whistles and alarms going off.
That's right.
And now that with a newer car, it tells me that I left my lights on. So any tips on getting the most for our headlight buck?
Yeah, don't forget to turn them off. If you get in the habit of clicking that little stick on the left by the time the button, well, every time you get out of the car, that's a good habit to have. But more of the newer vehicles, obviously, they tell you to shut them off, or they shut them off for you if you haven't had the key in ignition for several minutes. Every time you fill up for gas, grab the windshield wiper cleaner fluid thing out of that mucky little blue liquid there. And the windshield is one thing to clean, but then also clean your headlights and your taillights off. Make sure they're as visible as possible for you. Now, if you do actually burn through the bulb, you can replace them yourself, and it can cost anywhere from $20 for the bulb, up to $80 if you have to get the housing or whatever, and it typically costs about $40 to $50 of labor, depending on your mechanic and your vehicle, to have that person do it for you. If you are wise enough to have a pro do it for you, have them also check the angle of your headlights, because sometimes if they've been jarred loose or put in incorrectly, they can be staring off either into the side of the road, which doesn't provide a whole lot of help, or they stare across the lane of traffic, which provides a lot of glare for the other drivers.
We have an email from James. On the 2005 Prius, it requires about 3 hours to change the passenger side headlight bulb. At the dealer labor rate, that's one expensive bulb.
Yeah, it can be. The good news with a Prius is you're saving that much money and more on gas. And the other thing about a Prius is a smaller, lighter car. I would want to be seen by every single possible vehicle out there, so I think it's a worthy investment. But you may want to check with other providers and see if they are able to replace that bulb faster and for a lower cost mm-hmm. than what you're getting at the dealership.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin is with us just about every week at this time, sharing information and advice on your money. Time for more of your phone calls now, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Sarah in Madison is with us now. Hello, Sarah. You're on the air. Sarah, are you there? I'm sorry, Sarah. Looks like you lost interest. Jan in Bartlett is with us then. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question that's probably related only to us elderly and retired. When I was working, I used to buy bonds, government bonds, one or two a month. And, of course, that went away when I retired, and before that, apparently, they quit doing that. I'm wondering how I can find out the value of the bonds I've got now, and if I can buy them, how I could go about doing that.
Yeah, sure. These are savings bonds, Jen?
Yes. Yes, they are.
Okay. And do you happen to know what series they are? Like what letter? The H or double H or double E or...
I don't. I guess I whatever we used to what you could buy at work. I don't know.
Okay, that's fine. Go to treasurydirect.gov. Treasurydirect.gov is the Treasury's website that is in charge of not only helping people manage their savings bonds portfolio, but also purchase them as well. And they may or may not have you have the paper bonds, correct?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where are they buried? Just so I know. No. One of the issues with that, and it's not a huge issue, but technically you probably some of those bonds might have matured, meaning you've had them for more than 20 or 30 years.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I haven't had them more than 30 years.
Okay, good. The great news about those, Jan, is I bet those are earning actually a fairly competitive rate of interest considering how safe they are. So go to treasurydirect.gov and then put in your information. And it's a very common issue where people say, I have these bonds. I don't know what to do with them. If you want to buy more of them, the bad news is that they don't sell the paper bonds anymore. You have to do them just electronically if you do want to purchase more. And as we mentioned earlier, those Series I bonds can be a very wise choice if you're looking to set aside some safe money. But they'll help you not only submit the bonds into an account if you'd like, so you can manage the account online, but then also figure out what they're worth and what the value is and also what interest rate they're paying as well.
Good luck to you, Jan. Next we go to Sherry in Madison. Is this the Sherry we lost a little while ago?
Nope, it's not the Sherry you lost.
Okay, go ahead. It's a similar question anyway, so go ahead, Sherry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have two questions. One is about some inheritance money that I received. And I have $26,000 in the bank from that right now. We have about $2,000 in savings and about probably $5,000 in CDs. Mm-hmm. And my husband wants me to use $5,000 of that inheritance money to pay down to the principal of our home, which mm-hmm. we owe $89,000 on.
Sure.
And I'm thinking it's better to earn some money with that and save it in case we should need money to make payments.
No, I hate to tell you this, Sherry, but your husband is correct.
Oh, no.
I know. And I, if he calls back, I won't admit that. But if you're just looking at it in terms of earning some money on it, there is no place you can get as a predictable rate of return on safe liquid investments as what that mortgage is probably costing you in interest, especially if you're not deducting the interest on your taxes, which I assume you're not. And do you know what the interest rate is on that mortgage, Sherry?
It's 4.25.
Okay, so it's a good rate. I mean, it's a very competitive rate, but I understand what he's saying. I'm more concerned not with that you're missing out on the difference between what that money could be earning versus what it's costing you in interest. I'm more concerned about keeping that money liquid for emergencies, because if you keep it there, you can always get it. And if a financial emergency comes up and you've paid off that mortgage, either somewhat or all of it, it's very tough to get at that because by definition, you're in dire straits, and banks and credit unions typically don't like to lend money against homes to people who are in dire financial straits. And so I would vote for your decision. You're right for the wrong reasons. I don't want you to keep that money to try to invest it and outdo your cost of the mortgage, but I'd like you to keep it there and just make the payments as necessary. And then if you get to back to the point where you still have, you know, 6 months or better yet, a year worth of liquid savings, And then I would maybe accelerate the payments to the mortgage. But otherwise, that rate is very low. And if your saving rate is what I think it is, you're better off keeping that money liquid so in case an emergency comes up.
Okay, that's what I thought too. Okay, the other question is about investing in commodities. I want to invest in commodities. I have about $7,000 that I want to put in it, and I have no idea how to go about it.
I have good news for you. You shouldn't go about it. It's
I know you were going to say that. I believe God has told me to do that. And I am more interested in investing in some kind of food commodities that maybe are organic or something. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how to go about it.
I have a great solution for you. And who am I to argue with God? The best way to do that is to go get some organic seeds and plant them yourself, or put a very small amount of money in maybe a local cooperative if there is an organic cooperative or a community garden or something. But in terms of trying to invest in something with relatively limited assets and access to information, I think you, quite frankly, would be better off buying Powerball lottery tickets tomorrow.
Thank you, Sherry, for the call. Eileen in West Bend, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been using TurboTax for quite a few years now and never had a problem. And I was just wondering if you have know of any disadvantages to using TurboTax.
Have you been happy with it, Eileen?
So far.
I think it's a great way to go. I think it's actually for people who say, I want to do this on my own schedule. I don't want to have to try to make an appointment with someone, and I don't want to pay that person $200 to $2,000 when I can get TurboTax for $60 to maybe $100 and have it ask a lot of the same questions that this person would ask me and fill out the taxes. No, I think it's a fantastic way to go. I have no relation with them. I actually use a CPA to have that person do my taxes and help me with my planning, but I think TurboTax is fantastic, and I actually use the website quite a bit as a reference and to do tax planning too. So no, I think it's everything that I know about it is fantastic, and even when it comes to the other software programs, in the independent test, it usually beats the Tax Act and Tax Cutter and Tax Slayer and all these other ones fairly easily.
Way to go, Eileen. Time now for the website of the week.
We actually have two, and they are apps. We're going to have to change the name of the segment because we're going to start using more apps in the future. But these are for checking car maintenance and performance. DarrenSoft.ca/roadtrip and ZoneWalker.com/acar. Those are two apps. One is for the iPhone. That is Road Trip, and Acar for Android operating systems. And these are free or very low-cost apps you can put on your phone, and you can log in a lot of your maintenance data about your car, and it will send you reminders saying, hey, it's been several miles since you changed the oil or the fan belt. And the nice thing about that is not only does it give you a little bit of clue that says you need to have some maintenance done, but you'll have a record on hand of your maintenance history so that when you go to sell the car, you can print that out and say to the potential buyer, look, here's all the work that I've had done on this, and I've had it done regularly, so I've kept good care of the car. And we'll have links to both of those apps up at onyourmoney.com later on.
That sounds great. And we do have 30 seconds or so, a reminder of next week's Pledge Drive freemium.
Yes, retire early and forever. It covers our most popular topic and our most frequently asked questions about Social Security, saving for retirement, investing for retirement. How am I doing so far? How much can I spend once I'm retired? And that will be available to those who pledge at any dollar amount next week.
Looking forward to it, Kevin. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.